morning. My name is Jason Johnson. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm sober today by the grace of God and the solution I found in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And thanks, Mike, for the invite. I couldn't really say no to Mike, no matter what, because he's been at first of everything, so I'm kind of obligated, but I'd be here anyway. Thank you for the committee for the invite. And look, I'm the weak link in this day, right? So if everybody just lowers their standards just a little bit, it might be an okay meeting. You know, my sobriety date's 11-30-07. My sponsor is this guy named Carl Morris out of Covina, California. I'm his favorite. I am, really. You know, I'm self-appointed. But and I do go by the name of, for Christ's sakes, Jason. But I think I'm the favorite, right? My home group is called The Shed. We meet on Thursdays at noon. And I hate to say this, but it's at my house, right? So you're all welcome, but not all at once, maybe, a few at a time. But the reason that's my home group and the reason I love that group and the reason I know that it's a good group of people is that if I come into that meeting and I go up to a man or a woman and say, hey, I met a new person, and, you know, I think they'd be good for you to talk to. They don't ask me, say, hey, give me their number, let them call me or whatever. They always say, give me the number, I'll call them, right? Oh, so I have to start over? We're not doing that, right? I don't want to do it. I'm like, can you hear me now? I mean, Mike's going, yeah, so I figured everybody could hear me. So I have a home group. You're welcome there. You know, if you ever get anybody in the city of Portland or around the Portland area or even in the state of Oregon that needs help, get a hold of me, and I'll make sure they get to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, or I'll get a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous to them. You know, everything I have in my life that's of value or any good is a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? If you're new here, you're wanted, welcome, and needed in Alcoholics Anonymous. And here's what I know beyond a shadow of a doubt. Alcoholics Anonymous works, and God is real, right? And if I just buy into that, man, my life got a little bit better. Let's get on with this because I don't have a lot of time, and we're here all day. Did I say that out loud? That's how I get, for Christ's sakes, right? When Carl goes like this and says, for Christ's sakes, I'm on to something good. But if he goes like this and rubs his head, it usually means I'm in trouble, right? And I could feel that coming. Look, my mom and dad got divorced when I was little. I was like 2 or 3 years old. My dad took off. My mom was a hippie. I used to say she was an old hippie, but she was like 22. The reason I know she was a hippie, she smelled like a hippie, right? That patchouli smell or whatever. I don't know if you guys have hippies here, but yeah, I'm pretty sure you do. But the thing is we lived up in the woods with a bunch of other hippies, and sometimes we lived in a school bus before it was popular. We lived in a teepee, a log cabin. We even lived in a house that looked like a gingerbread house built on the back of a truck with a wood stove. And what my mom did for a living, she grew pot, right? And I know it's called THC nowadays, or cannabis, right? I spoke at a young people's, and they said it's not called pot anymore. But back then, in the early 70s, it was pot. And my mom grew that, and we lived up with a bunch of other hippies that smelled like my mom. And you know what? During the day, it was a great place to live. But at night, they would start drinking and using, and they'd start beating on each other. And I mean, I'd see my mom get beat up, and I'd see my mom beating up somebody else, right? But I didn't think there was anything wrong with that. I knew it was odd, but I didn't think there was anything wrong with that, because the next morning, I would see them hugging each other and loving each other and telling each other they loved each other, right? So it didn't make me an alcoholic or an addict. What it did is it gave me some life skills, right? It taught me that when that tension started to build up and I could feel that, I either ran and hid, or I tried to de-escalate it by talking. Again, I didn't know there was anything wrong with that. When I started going to kindergarten, my mom moved to town. When my mom moved to town, she had a party house. It's one of those houses at 2 o'clock in the morning, there might be 20 people in that house, or at 2 o'clock in the morning, it might only be me as a little kid. And that night, it was always me by myself. And I learned how to survive, right? I learned that when it got dark outside, you pull all the blinds down, you turn all the lights on, you turn the TV up really loud. That way, if somebody comes to break in, they're going to think there's a party going on, and they'll kill the neighbors, right? And I'm still alive, so it worked, right? And that's what my life was like. I didn't know there was any Leave It to Beaver. I didn't know people read stories to their kids. I learned how to make macaroni and cheese on the stove. I learned how to make popcorn on the stove. I learned how to draw my own bath. And I was okay with that. Again, I had nothing to measure it up to, right? Because I didn't know any different. And my life changed when I was getting ready to go into the first grade. It was the Sunday before the first day of school, and I'm at home on a Sunday night watching this show called Happy Days. Oh, for Christ's sakes. Somebody knows what Happy Days is, right? Thank you. Thank you. I mean, this is an older crowd. It's not like a Wacky Paw or something like that, right? And who usually they start Googling right about now, right? And then they laugh. And I'm watching Happy Days and the phone rings. And it's not like today where it goes to a message or it goes to caller ID. It rings until that person gives up, right? Or you pick up. Something's got to happen. It just doesn't stop, right? And it rang all the way till commercial. So I thought, man, it must be important. So I answered it, and it was my grandma. And I don't know if there's any grandmas in here, but man, you guys are way too invested in your grandkids' lives, right? You want to know, have I taken a bath? Have I got my clothes laid out? Am I excited to go to school? Have I got my new shoes? Did I eat dinner? Stuff has absolutely nothing to do with Happy Days. And this lady's just going on and on. And finally I told grandma, I got to go. My show's back on. She said, sweetie, let me talk to your mom. I said, oh, my mom's not here. She's down at the tavern. The phone number is 282-4440. If you call that, this guy Floyd's going to answer the phone, ask for Darla. It's going to take her 4 or 5 minutes to get to the phone. She's going to tell you she's having one more pitcher of beer, and she'll be home. Right? And there was a long pause, and she said, sweetie, give me that number again, and I gave it to her. And she said, when your show's over, I want you to go to bed, and when you go to school tomorrow, I want you to listen to what the teacher says and be nice to the other kids. That's basically what Carl tells me today, you know? Just be generous with my time and kind to others, right? And you should be all right. And I said, all right, and I hung up that phone, and now I'm watching this show called Laverne and Shirley, and there's a knock on the door, right? And I kind of panic, and then they start beating on the window, and I crawl underneath this end table, and I start piling pillows up because I'm scared, right? Because I know I'm going to die. Somebody's breaking into the house. But all of a sudden, I hear this Jason open the door. It's grandma, man, and I got relief just like that, right? And I went to that door, and my grandma was standing there, and she didn't look like grandma. She looked like she'd been crying. She looked mad. She just didn't have that, hey, come here, give me a hug look, right? She said, sweetie, get your stuff. You're coming to live at my house. That's like hitting the lottery, right? Because when you go to grandma's house, there's Rice Krispie treats. There's homemade cookies. There's popsicles in the freezer. There's sheets on the bed. The sheets match the pillowcases. But the biggest sell to that thing is there's somebody there all the time, right? I'm in. I grab my little bit of stuff, jump in her car. We run to her house. I'm running through the front room, headed to the kitchen, and I hear this, hey, and I turn around. It's my grandpa. He's like, what are you doing here? I was like, man, I live here now. I didn't know my grandma didn't run it by him. Found out later. But you know what he did? He looked right at me. He says, yeah, you do, buddy. Come here. And he gave me a hug, and I fell asleep on that man's lap every night for the next 2 or 3 years because he made me feel safe. Right? And I wasn't an easy kid. I ended up at this podium. Right? So it isn't. I'm the kind of kid, my grandma would take me to Sunday school, and when we get to Sunday school class, she'd just push me in there and say, he has an enthusiasm for life, and she would take off down the hall, right? My grandpa would drop me off somewhere, and he'd look at these people, and he'd say, hey, don't let his cuteness get in the way of your common sense. He's either going to be in trouble or talking his way out of trouble, right? That's all you need to know. And he would take off. And I used to think that was bizarre, right? And but I guess they were onto something, because I remember I was in the third grade, and this is my first police contact, really, and it sounds bad, but I was in the third grade, and it was career day at our school, and on Friday, and everybody's going to dress up and be whatever they wanted to be when they grew up, right? And so on Wednesday, I remember Miss Bo going around the class, and she's asking everybody in the class what they wanted to be, and there was, like, doctors, lawyers, firemen, policemen, there are a lot of policemen, and it got to me, and she said, Jason, what are you going to be when you grow up? And I said, a bank robber, right? And I was just as shocked as she was, right? You know what I mean? I wasn't my career choice, but I had two friends that changed careers right away, so I had a gang, so I had to kind of hang in there. And I went home that day with a letter, and I came back as a rodeo clown, but that's a whole nother story. But here's the thing. That Saturday, I remember sitting on the underneath the apple tree with my neighbor Stevie, and he was going to be a police officer, and I was going to be a bank robber. And we were talking about our careers, and I said, you know, we play cops and robbers all the time, but there was no banks on my block to rob. But he said there was a Kool-Aid stand. And so I went and got a BB gun and a bandana and a cowboy hat, and I rode my bike up to the corner Kool-Aid stand, and I robbed it. And look, if you're going to rob a Kool-Aid stand, there's some things you need to know. You're too old, right? But most importantly, they don't have any money. All they have is Kool-Aid, right? And so I robbed this Kool-Aid stand, and it's just not going like it should, so I took a kid hostage. And I held him for ransom. I took him back to my backyard, and I tied him up to the clothesline pole. And I told everybody else to go get their piggy banks and meet me in my backyard. But here's the deal. At 5 o'clock at my house is dinner. When my grandma yells dinner, if you don't go eat dinner, you don't eat. Right? So I have this kid tied up to the thing, and I'm waiting for his friends to bring me their money. And I hear dinner. I'm like, whoa, I got to go. Right? And so I'll be back in about 20 minutes, and I made some mistakes. I put my bandana, my BB gun, and cowboy hat down right next to him, and I went inside, and I'm eating dinner, and everything's going fine until a police officer arrived. And then when this police officer arrived, the whole neighborhood arrives, right? So everybody in my neighborhood, every parent, everybody is in the backyard. And this kid's crying and squirming and making the knots really tight. And it's just not going my way. And my grandpa starts laughing, like really loud. And that set my grandma into a tailspin. And she said, "What's so funny?" He goes, "Man, you can't make this up." And that must have been the wrong thing to say, because I got grounded for a month to the house, right? And I remember my grandpa going, "Hey, hold on a second." And he took my grandma behind the house, because you don't argue in public, I guess, or debate. And he comes back and he says, "Look, buddy, I didn't tie that young man up to the clothesline pole. There's no need to punish me by grounding you to the inside of the house for 30 days. You're grounded to the block," right? And I thought right away, man, that guy became my hero. He taught me how, when you get in trouble, to share in a general way. He taught me a lot of things about life. But here's the thing, what I realized today is that guy was a good person, right? He was a good human being. He's the kind of guy that if you dropped a quarter on the ground, he'd spend a dollar to get it back to you if he knew it was yours. And as I got older, we grew apart, because I thought he just didn't like me, right? I thought he felt sorry for me. I thought he hated me, because he was always turning me in. And we grew apart. My grandma, on the other hand, I thought she felt sorry for me. And the reason I thought she felt sorry for me is because every time I had a baseball game or any kind of sporting event, all my aunts and uncles came. If somebody went on vacation, my grandma made them take me. Hey, somebody's got to take. If they went on vacation, Jason went, right? I'm always that third wheel. And as a little kid, I knew that. I knew that the only reason they were there is because everybody felt sorry for me. And I did what I had to do. I acted out a lot, and I got a lot of trouble. But, you know, I remember being in the sixth grade, and it was middle school, and I started taking a school bus, and I got kicked off of school buses. Imagine that. And it's my first day to walk home, and as I'm getting ready to leave the school, I see my grandma pulling up, and she's walking in. And I was like, "Yeah, she's here to pick me up and give me a ride." She says, "Sweetie, we got to go into this office and to talk to some people." And we went into this office, and this table, there was a table just like this. And on one side, there was a teacher, a principal, a counselor, a lady from a special needs student school, and a couple of other teachers in this one side of the table. And there was two chairs, and we sat down. And they proceeded to tell my grandma everything I'd done wrong in the last 3 months, that I had no self-control, that I hit other kids, that I talked all the time, that I couldn't read and write at that level, and that I really probably shouldn't be in that grade, right? And I remember my grandma hadn't said anything. She just sitting there, right? And I was thinking, man, grandpa should have came. And when they got done talking, she said, "May I say something?" They said, "Sure." She said, "Look, I'm not going to deny Jason did any of those things. He lives at my house. He's a tough kid, but he's a good kid. And there's a good person inside of there. The reason I know this is every morning on his way to school, he runs down to Mrs. Harrington's house and he throws her newspaper up on the front porch so she doesn't have to walk down the stairs. And the young man, Shane, who's simple-minded, every time I see him at the grocery store or church on Sunday, the first thing he asks is, 'Where's Jason?' Because nobody picks on him when Jason's around, and Jason always picks him first for sports when they play on teams. Nobody told Jason to do those things. He did them on his own. So I know there's a good kid inside of there. It's our responsibility to tap into that." You know, and I ended up having my best year of school that year. But most importantly, I remember walking out of that classroom, walking down that hall, and looking at my grandma and thinking, for the first time in my life, somebody loved me, right? And somebody believed in me. And that lady, I went wherever she went, right? You know, that young man I tied up to the clothesline pole, Sean, became one of my best friends. I guess I need Al-Anon, right? I took him hostage right off the bat, and we went over to Leif's house, and we're going to sleep in the backyard. It's like here, you don't sleep in the backyard a lot when it rains, and so it's a Friday night, and we're in the backyard, and we're setting up for the night, and Leif's mom walks out and said, "Hey, I ordered you guys a pizza. There's $10 on the counter. Pay the pizza guy when he gets here and stay in the house. The adults are all going bowling." We're like, great. They take off. The pizza guy comes. We're getting ready to eat pizza, and Leif says, "Pizza tastes better with beer." I'd never drank beer before, and I said, "Yes, it does." And he went downstairs and he got a case of Lucky Lager beer. Yeah, it's nasty, right? Some of you people say you drank it and you had to, "Oh, I have a ride." I had to plug my nose and hang in there, right? I'm gagging this stuff down. We're in the backyard throwing rocks at cars and having a great time. And all of a sudden, man, I just said, "Man, I got food poisoning. I don't feel good," right? I just got sicker than a dog. And there was something wrong with that pizza. And so I said, "I got to go home." I rode my bike home, which Leif says was my first DUI. He came to hear me talk. But I got home, I go into my grandma's house, I tell her I don't feel good, she looks at me with disgust. I'm in my room all night sick, and nobody comes and checks on me. Grandmas are not like that. Usually they bring a towel, put it on the pillow, they bring a bucket, they turn on the fan, they night, nothing from that lady, crickets. And I'm sick all night, man. I'm like sick, nothing from anybody. I finally fall asleep, and the next morning I wake up, my grandpa's at the end of my bed yelling, "Get up, you got to go to work." I was like, man, I don't even have a job. You know what I mean? He's like, "Get up, go to work." I said, "I don't feel good." And he said to me, "If you're going to drink like a big boy, you're going to work like a big boy. Now let's go." And I thought for sure, well, I thought for sure my grandma would do her job, but she didn't. She handed me a warm egg salad sandwich and a thermos of warm milk and told me, have a great day. And we went and picked up Leif and Sean, who looked just as bad as I did, and my grandpa took us to pick strawberries. It is against the law for a minor to pick berries in the state of Oregon if you're under 12 years old. Somebody should thank me for that someday down the line. But man, it was legal then. And I mean, I made 27 cents. I picked strawberries, I got sick. I picked strawberries, I got sick. And I looked at my buddies and I said, man, I'm not drinking anymore. They said, you don't like the alcohol? I said, I don't mind the alcohol, I just don't want to work. Right? So I quit cold turkey. No AA, no 12 steps. Nothing, right? I'm doing good until I got to high school. And because of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I realized this is where the obsession kicked in for me. Because what I found out is I was saving my lunch money Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, pitching in with some other guys, shoulder tapping and drinking on the weekends. We played sports during the week and we drank on the weekends. Nobody was dying of a heroin overdose. Nobody was going to jail. We just had fun, right? And everything was good till December, or what was it, March 5th, 1989. Carl says, I need to tell you the truth. I stole the motorcycle. I used to say I borrowed it. I stole the motorcycle. I got in a high-speed chase, and I crashed on this bridge in Portland. And I woke up in an ICU unit not knowing what was going on, right? One of those that has a sliding glass door with just you in it. And I'm yelling, I'm alive, and a nurse comes in and says, we know you're alive. I asked her what happened. She said, you're in a drunk driving accident on a motorcycle. I told her I don't own a motorcycle. She said, we know. I asked her if I'm going to die. She said, you're not going to die, but you're probably going to lose your left leg. And if you don't lose your left leg, you'll never walk normal again. And I made a decision right there in that hospital bed that I'll never drink alcohol ever again. Right? I would never put anybody's life in jeopardy, but I'm an alcoholic. And when I got out, the only way I know how to kill those voices and that anxiety and that fear is to drink. Right? And I would do that over and over and over. So simply, I started lowering my standards to keep up with my quality of life. Right? And eventually, I'm living in a house. It's an abandoned house with a bunch of people. And every once the police would come and we'd have to move. Today, I guess they call them tents. But back then, it was abandoned houses. And that's what my life was, right? And I was okay with that. But about once a month, one of my uncles would show up wherever I was at and drag me down to a payphone. I go, why do I got to go to a payphone? You got to call grandma. Because every morning, she calls every institution, every jail, every hospital. And then she calls all your friends. And then she calls all of us every single morning. Has anybody seen Jason? Is Jason alive? Can somebody please go find Jason? You need to call her and tell her you're okay so she'll leave us alone. And I would go to that payphone and I'd call my grandma and I'd tell her, grandma, I'm doing really good. I'm working out of town. And I got a great job. You know what I mean? And I'll come see you when I get back. And look, I meant that. I'm not a bad guy, right? But I'm powerless over alcohol. And when I put alcohol in my body, I justify not going, right? Because if I don't see you, I'm not buying to you and I'm not stealing from you. I'm doing you a favor, right? And I would do that over and over and over. And every once in a while, I'd go to my grandma's house, and this is how sly she was. She would leave $5 in her purse sticking out or $5 on the counter, and she'd walk away knowing I would steal it, right? And I would do that, and I would tell her I was doing really good. And that would go on and on and on. And, you know, on December 4th, 1997, my Uncle Leroy showed up. I was living in a tent in the backyard of an abandoned house. And he said that my grandma had been in ICU at Portland Adventist and that I should probably come say goodbye because they took her off of life support. I told him, I don't really want to go. He said, I'm not really asking you if you want to go. He's a big biker guy, so I went. And we get in his truck. He hands me a pint of vodka, and he tells me to drink it, and I chug it. And by the time we get to this hospital, I'm okay being a piece of crap that's not going to amount to nothing, right? And I remember getting off that elevator, and I have a big family, and they're all sitting on one side, and I went to the other side of the room because I'm that guy, right? I'm that guy that's failed everybody in my family. I'm the guy that when there is a family function and I get invited to it, if a commercial came on for a treatment, everybody stopped what they were doing and looked at me, right? So we all know I'm that guy. Stuff gets stolen. Stuff comes up missing. And I got off that elevator, and I went and sat over here because I don't need anybody to tell me that. I know I'm that guy. And alcohol makes that all right, right? And finally, my mom didn't even come over. Finally, my aunt came over and said, you need to go in there, say goodbye, and get out of here, right? Because they were only letting a couple people into my grandma's room at a time. And I walked into this room, and my Uncle Gary is there. He said, man, talk to her like she's here. She hasn't been awake all day, but just hold her hand and take as long as you want. Don't worry about anybody else. And I sat down, and I grabbed her hand. I start talking to her, and she opens her eyes, and then she starts talking back to me, right? And I panicked, right, because people had flown in to see her, so they started coming to the door, and I did what I always do. I told Grandma, I'm doing really good. I have a great job, but there's a lot of people here that would like to see you. I'll come back tomorrow and visit you. And she told me she'd love me, and she would pray for me. But I remember as I was walking out of that room, she looked at my Uncle Gary, who's in the program. She said, he's a good kid. You watch. He's going to do something with his life. and I just nutted up, man. I went back to my tent, and I drank the way you drink. And the day that my grandma passed, my Uncle Dale showed up at my tent, and he said that she'd pass, and his family would come pick me up to sit with them at the memorial. Maybe I could shower. And I said, okay, and that day came, and I hid in a closet in an abandoned house with some Goldschläger and some Jägermeister, and I didn't come out, right? Because all I know how to do to self-medicate on that, because my thinking is if I can't show up for somebody that loved me no matter what, how can I show up for when she's passed? I didn't want to ruin it for her, right? And I didn't want to take, you know, whatever justification you is, I didn't come out of that closet. A couple days later, the guilt and the shame and the alcohol wasn't really working. I was still getting drunk, but I couldn't kill that voice, right? And so I called my uncle and asked him if he was going to church, because we're like 8 years apart, and I knew he was going to beat me up, right? Because we grew up together in the same house, but I was pretty sure he went beat me up in church. I go to this church, they started singing that song, How Great Thou Art, or something like that. And then they sang that dang song, Amazing Grace. And as they're singing it, I looked at my uncle. I said, man, I think I got a drinking problem. He's like, you think? And the whole church went quiet. I said, I might have a problem with drugs, too, if it makes you feel better about yourself. And this is what he said. Come over to my house. You can shower. We'll wash your clothes. We'll feed you. We'll give you $20, and you can figure out what you're going to do with your life. I went to his house. I took a shower. When I came out, he says, you're going to go to treatment. I said, what's that? He said, this is no time for negotiations. Look up treatment centers. So I looked up a hospital, Portland Adventist, and I called it. I didn't think they'd be open on Sunday, but they were. I told this lady, I have a drinking problem. She got all excited, passed me over to another lady. I told this lady, I have a drinking problem, maybe a drug problem. It makes you feel better about yourself. And she said, can you be here tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. for an assessment? I said, I sure can. And I got off the phone. I told my uncle, I think I have an assessment thing. Give me $20. I'll tell you how it went. He said, no, I'll take you. So I had to stay the night at his house. It was miserable. I was sweating from the inside out. I hadn't had anything in my body for a few days. He has a plastic couch. He says it's leather. He has a little dog that licked me all night. You can just imagine, it wasn't good, right? It wasn't good at all. I wake up the next morning, he says, man, you look like hell. And I wanted to tell him what I thought about his couch, but I didn't. I went in, I took a shower. When he went to take a shower, I remembered he had a liquor cabinet. I went and got a Coke can, put some Bacardi 151 in it. And I started drinking it. Man, I feel better. I'm ready to go to treatment. We get in his truck, and we're driving there. He goes, man, I smell alcohol. I said, it's not me. I'm going to treatment. He just looked at me like, you got to be kidding me, right? And then we get there, and I made a vital mistake, man. I went and hid my can in the bathroom, and he went and answered this question, yes to something. And I'm in treatment just like that. It was December 29th, 1997. There was four other guys in there. This treatment center was bad. I mean, it was really bad. It had no caffeine, it had no sugar, and it had no women. I'm 29 years old living in the bushes, but those are some big deals, right? If I'm going to go on vacation, they need to have those things. So I didn't know you could just leave detox and treatment. I thought you had to escape. Right, so I watched shift changes. I watched the elevator go up and down. And, you know, I'm planning. I'm out of here, man. As soon as I can catch a break, I'm done. And these four guys that need to be in AA or recovery, they're in this treatment center. They start talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, man, what's Alcoholics Anonymous? And they go, oh, this is what it is. And this is the miracle that got me to AA. It really is. They said there's caffeine, there's sugar, and there's women. I said, yeah. How do we get there? They said, a van's going to pick us up and take us. I'm like, even better, I can escape from there, man. I'm in. I get in this van. I'm going to tell you, when I was 26 years old, my dad called my mom out of the blue to pay back all the back child support he owed. I went to that bank for 30 seconds to maybe 3 minutes to say hi, got my half of the money, and I left. I had to pay that money back because of sponsorship, but that's another story. I said hi to the guy. I don't need a dad. I haven't seen you in 26 years. Why would I want to see you now? And I went and did what I had to do. I'm in this van going to this thing called ANA. And I pray to this God, please don't let me know anybody in AA. And if I do, please don't let me owe him any money. Right? Nothing about staying sober. I just need to get out of here. Right? We get to this thing. There's caffeine. There's sugar. And there's some ladies in this meeting. And I'm looking around seeing who I'm going to marry to bust me out of this treatment center. Right? And I'm looking back there, and I see a guy standing there. I said, man, that looks like my dad. They said, you don't know who your dad is? I said, I've seen him one time in 26 years or 29 years. And they said, well, you got to go say something. So they have a break, and I walk up to this guy at the break. I said, hey, do you know who I am? He said, no. I said, I think you're my dad. And he said, Jason. And I met my dad at the very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and Mike was standing right there, right? My grandma, when I was a little kid, my grandma said, God either says yes, not right now, or I got something better. God never says no. I used to think that was the stupidest thing in the world. But I'm here to tell you, when I was a little kid, you know, probably first, second grade, coming home on a Friday, sitting on that front porch with a bag of clothes waiting for my mom or dad to come pick me up to take me somewhere for the weekend, And they went show. And I remember sitting out there this one Friday, and I sat there till the street light came on. And I went in, I put my bag down, I went into the kitchen, and I told my grandma, hey, I'm not going to your Sunday school anymore. She said, why is that? I said, I've been praying to that Jesus guy every morning and every night that my mom or dad would come pick me up this weekend and take me somewhere, and they didn't show. So he don't like me, so I'm not going no more. And I could see my grandma starting to cry. She said, okay. And I went in and I got on my grandpa's lap and I said, Grandpa, I don't want to sit on that front porch ever again. He said, buddy, you never have to sit on that front porch if you don't want to ever again. And I said, okay. And I made a decision right then and there that I don't need a God and I don't need a mom and a dad, right? I'm 29 years old. I'm sitting on that front porch on a Friday night waiting for members for Alcoholics Anonymous to pick me up and take me to a meeting, right? And it's not like today when they text you and say they're on their way. They start honking like two blocks away, right? Because they want everybody to know we're getting Jason for AA. And I run down to that car, and you know who's there? My dad and Mike. God either says yes, not right now, or I got something better. I just have to trust the process. And I get in this van. They take me to this meeting. I met this girl. I kissed her. She got pregnant. She got divorced, and then we got married. Yeah, that's one of those right here with Carl, for Christ's sakes. And if you're new here, that's not how you do in relationships. But we're still married today. But, it ain't always in a row. Don't nobody get excited. It's not in a row, right? Where was I? Oh, I got married. We got a kid, and my life started getting a little bit better. But, man, I was only doing one meeting a month at the end for my first 3 years. I did a lot at the beginning. These guys drug me around. But I got to this point. I was a raffle chair at a meeting called SSAL. Sit down, shut up, and listen. It was a speaker meeting with about 400 or 500 people. I was only going there because I was stealing half the money, which I had to pay back. I mean, you got to watch who you get for a sponsor and what they read in the big book. Because how I read the big book and how they read the big book sometimes aren't interpreted the same way. Like, it's their money, not your money and stuff like that you have to pay back. And I was only going to this meeting, and it was a Saturday night, and I didn't want to go. So I got in a fight with my wife and asked her for a divorce. She said no. I didn't know you could just do that. She said, I'm going to the meeting. Maybe you should go. She went to this meeting, and I did what every good alcoholic does who's resigning from Alcoholics Anonymous. I wrote a letter. And I dated it, and I signed it, and I was going to take it. I took it to this guy named John B. John B., I thought, was the president of AA in our area because he had a whole bunch of Nottigans, right? Those ones that, you know, you show up, they're greeters, and they want to touch you all the time, and you're like, good God, not again. And, you know, or they get called on in the meeting. They talk about God, sponsorship, the allergy, the body. This stuff has absolutely nothing to do with AA when you're first new. And I was like, not again, right? And he had a bunch of them, maybe 20, right? And so I thought he was the president of AA, and he was the chair of this meeting. So I walked up, I handed him my letter of resignation. He opens it up and starts reading it and starts laughing, like really loud, right? Laughing like Disneyland, right? And all the Nottigans are swarming around, and they're passing the letter around, and they're laughing, and I'm sweating. And he says, no. I go, what do you mean, no? He goes, I'm not going to allow you to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. And what accidentally came out of my mouth is, will you sponsor me? Yeah, he quit laughing. It's like that. He said, are you willing to go to any length for victory over alcohol? I was like, man, I was just resigning with a letter from AA that's going to haunt me for the next 25 years. Yeah, but yeah, I'm good. And he said, this is what you're going to do. You're going to get on your knees every morning, and you're going to say, please help, thank you, amen. And at night, you're going to get on your knees, and you're just going to say, thanks. God don't need to hear any more from you. You'll be trying to con him or something like that. And he said, I had to read 2 pages out of the big book every day. I had to call him every morning at 6:30 in the morning, which I should get a better job. And then he said, I had to go to 5 meetings a week. Whoa, to where he was. All right. And I couldn't drink in between meetings, but if you're doing all that, you don't have time. And next thing I know, I became a Nottigan, right? I was the head greeter, another self-appointed spot, but I was at the front of the line. And my job in Alcoholics Anonymous was to shake every woman's hand that walked through the door and make sure she felt safe. And every guy that walked through the door, I had to hug and tell them I'm doing better every day in every way. Very unnecessary, very uncalled for. Some of those guys made 2 or 3 trips around to get hugs. Yeah, I'm not that guy, but I did it, right? But here's what happened. In about 9 years of sobriety, I couldn't stand you people, right? I knew what Mike was going to say. He's going to talk about hiking. I knew what Ralph was going to say. Masoon doesn't like anybody. I mean, so I sit in the back of the room just pissed off, right? So I started selling drugs. Like nobody in here has ever thought of selling drugs sober, right? Thank you, right? Good God. It's not like we're at a church choir thing or something here, but I got pretty good at it, right? And so I bought this car, and I took it to this place called Les Schwab, and I put wheels and tires on it, and as I'm pulling out, the wheel fell off, and I crashed, and kind of bummed out, but Les Schwab said, hey, that's our fault, and they rented me this thing called the Chrysler 300, this thing, a car called the Chrysler 300. It had tinted windows that said Hemi on the side. It looked like a Rolls Royce. I thought I had arrived. I went and met this guy I'd been meeting every day for about a year, and I'm driving down the road, and a bunch of cops swarm my car. I guess they call it a task force, right? But I haven't had a drink or drug in 9 years. I've been going to AA. I have a valid driver's license, proof of insurance, and I have a job. So I should probably be able to talk my way out of whatever seems to be the mistake going on here. But I have this substantial amount of dope. Well, they weighed it at 157 grams of meth, right? So I put it underneath the front seat because I figured they wouldn't find it, right? And if they did, I said it came with a rental car. I've only had it for like an hour, right? Sure enough, I put my dope underneath the front seat. You kick it with your foot, you know, and an officer walks up, and I roll down the window because I didn't want them to know I knew they were there. He said, Jason, which is another bad sign. He said, could you shut the car off and step up on the curb? I said, I sure can. And I shut the car off, and I open up the door to get out. And as I get out of here, and I look down, and the seat's moving back all by itself. Right? I've never, until this day, have a car that the seat moves back by itself. Right? It went all the way back. And you can't yell do-over, right, or time out, you know, or you really can't reach down underneath the seat and grab something, right, because everybody has a gun but you. And I went up on that curb, and I got charged with commercial delivery, commercial possession, racketeering, intimidation of a federal witness, and a gun charge. The gun was in the trunk with 9 years of sobriety going to AA meetings. Yeah, that was a good way to put it, baby. And I burned it to the ground. Right? I put a needle in my arm and I started drinking. I did stuff I thought I'd never do. My wife divorced me, which I used to think was a bad call, which I realized it was a great call. She has remarried me, which I think is a great call. AA, my area, thinks it's a bad call. You know what I mean? So we're still working on that. But man, I burned it to the ground. You know, I did things and I said things what you do, right? And I just put alcohol in and made it all right. Right? And I ended up getting sentenced to 48 months in prison. In my first 3 weeks, I was in the hole. I'll just give you some advice. If you get arrested in the state of Oregon, the sheriff's office has been running the jail system since the 1800s. They don't need your opinion. I helped you out. If you got anything out of AA, that'll help you right there when you get there. I gave my opinion. I'm in this hole by myself. I had anxiety and fear. And I got on my knees and I said, please help. Thank you. Amen. I got back on my bunk. If I got any relief, I got back on my knees and I said, thanks. One day I looked in that mirror and I realized I was guilty, right? They had the right person. But for the first time in my life, I admitted to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. I didn't have to tell anybody else. And my life changed just like that. At 3 months and 27 days of being locked up, some judges in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in my area signed a piece of paper to get me a suspended sentence. And I was released to serve my time in the community. I still had to do 4 years, but the state of Oregon was my prison cell. And then I had to do parole. And I've been an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing since that day. There's some people from Oregon, and sometimes I show you what to do and what not to do, and they're both equally as important. But what happened, man, is I went in there as my life changed, right? And I got out, and all I know how to do is start doing Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started doing it to the best of my ability, man. And my life started getting better and better. You know, I remember my lowest point when I was out using. I remember when my daughter was born, we started saving those quarters. My daughter was 8 years old at the time. My daughter, we saved those quarters with the states on the back, and we had a couple buckets of them, and my ex-wife would let me come over to her house. Just make sure I clarify that, because none of that's mine now. It wasn't my wife, it wasn't my house then. But she let me come over there, I'd take a shower, and she'd let me see my daughter if I looked like I was okay. One day I took a shower, and I'm coming out, and here she comes down, and she has these buckets, they're all empty. And she said, man, you stole your daughter's money. Who steals a little kid's money? But alcoholism tells me you wouldn't have that money if I didn't put it in there, right? But what happened, my daughter's tugging on my wife's pants, saying, please don't make my daddy leave. I let him borrow it. When my daughter was born, I held her, and I told her nobody would ever steal from her, take from her, or hurt her. And what I realized right then and there, I'm that guy, right? And I went and I did what I had to do. So when I got back out of that thing, I had to make that right. Today, my daughter just graduated from law school for her master's, and she's getting ready to take her do for her attorney thing. But, man, I don't know, a few months ago, I was walking through the kitchen. There's a bunch of sorority girls in our house. They're trying to get my daughter to run for president of the United States in her Portland State. And so I said, hey, can I have a cabinet position? She said, no. Didn't even hesitate, right? I said, well, what can I do at the White House? She said, you could be a greeter. So if she makes it to the presidency, you better get there fast. I probably won't have the job for long. But here's the thing. Those same girls were sitting in there, and one of them asked my daughter, isn't your dad's past going to ruin your career? And my daughter, without even missing a beat, said, my dad's past is my greatest asset. Right? That's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. She's got to see me burn it to the ground. She saw me build it back up. You know, I'm not the easiest guy to live with. My daughter was 17 years old. My wife and my daughter went on vacation. Well, my wife came to me and said, hey, we're going on vacation. I said, where? She said, Canada. I said, I can't go there. She said, we know. And away they went, right? And they're gone for like 2 weeks. And I wasn't dog sitting. I was watching my dog. Whatever you want to say. I say dog sitting, but it's just me and the dog. They're gone. They come back. My daughter goes straight to her room. My wife walks in and says, we need to talk. I said, about what? She said, I need to talk to you, and it's serious, and you can't overreact. I said, sure, give it to me. She said, when Bailey and I were in Canada, Bailey got a tattoo. Oh, I saw tramp stamp. I saw stripper poles. I saw Aerosmith videos. I lost it, man. I went batshit crazy. I called my wife names I shouldn't call anybody. I told her she's going to prison. We're getting a divorce, and I got to get that tattoo removed from my daughter's back, right? And yeah, it wasn't going good with her, so I went upstairs, and I laid into my daughter. Man, I said things to her that if you said to her, I have no problem going back to jail, right? And I said things, and she just sat on that bed and cried. And I did what every good alcoholic does in a situation like this. I got in my car, and I started driving. I called an Al-Anon, right? Because I figured an Al-Anon would know how to get my wife arrested, how to get a divorce, and how to get that tattoo removed, right? There's got to be. I can't be the first person that's had this problem, right? So I call this Al-Anon as I'm driving down the road, and I'm trying to explain to her on my speakerphone what happened. And here's the difference between Al-Anon and AA. I call Alcoholics Anonymous. Mike gives me the solution for my problem before I'm even done explaining. That's AA. Al-Anon, I don't know if they write it down. I don't know if they send it out in a text and get other people's opinion. But, man, I don't know if they listen to everything you say. But it took her like 2 miles before I got an answer, right? She goes, you want to know what just happened? I go, well, yeah, I told you this problem 3 times. What did you hear? She said, man, you just told your daughter she's not beautiful, and any decisions she makes are not to your standard, and her body's your. Man, she said a lot of stuff that made me sound bad, right? I don't want to say it here because it does sound bad. I said, I didn't mean that. She goes, I know you didn't. She goes, you need to go back and make that right. And I could hear her husband in the background yelling, you better invite God to go with you. So I'm driving down the road going like that because I don't need AA's help. But I got to my driveway, and I did what you guys told me to. I invited God to go with me, and I went in that house. I told my wife I overreacted. She said, you did. And I went upstairs, and my 17-year-old daughter's still sitting on that bed crying. And I had to make that amends. Right? I said, I don't care what you do with your body. I don't care who you love. I don't care anything. All you need to know is you're the best thing I've ever done in this world, and I love you no matter what. She goes, I know, Dad. She goes, you want to see the tattoo? I'm like, yeah, whatever, right? She lifts up the side of her shirt, and there's an AA symbol on her side of her chest, and it says one day at a time, and there's a hand going like this and a hand like going like this. My first thought is, and I use my inside voice, is, God, I hope you're not an alcoholic, and what's with the praying hands? We're not Catholic. But I didn't say anything out loud. She goes, you want to know what it means? I said, sure. She said, if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, you and Mom would have never met, and I wouldn't be here. I was like, oh, that's pretty good, right? And she said, the hand going like this is Mom's hand because she's always serving the coffee and making the cookies for the meeting. And the hand going like this is yours, Dad, because you're always welcoming people to Alcoholics Anonymous and give them a hand up. So now I'm on the edge of the bed crying. Paul Epistle said that was God kicking me in the nuts. So I avoid her like the plague, right? But that's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I can make an ass out of myself, and I can still come back and make that right. You know, I have a little bit more time. I want to talk about the amends with my grandparents. My grandpa was still alive, so I went to his house. I said, Grandpa, I don't know if you know this or not, but I stole a lot of money and borrowed a lot of money from you and Grandma. He goes, I know. I said, I don't know how much. He goes, I do. He goes into my grandma's room, and he comes back out with these spiral notebooks. My grandma was like the mob, right? From 1977, Jason borrowed 5 cents. Jason had borrowed 25 cents. Jason Modlon has credit. Every contract, every IOU to 1995. Yeah, not doesn't make any sense at all, right? And I'm looking at my grandpa, and there's stacks. I'm like, I can't pay all this back. He goes, oh, I know you can't. I said, what can I do? He said, man, you just keep helping others. I said, all right, I can do that. But it was kind of like your history of your life, right? Because there's IOUs, there's when you got, they give you money every week. I mean, I had budgets, I had everything in these things, right? And in 1984, it said, Jason stole $5. Jason stole $5. Jason stole $5. I said, hey, Grandpa, how do you know I stole $5? He goes, that's an easy one. He goes, every Thursday, I put $5 in the coffee cup in the hutch. Every Friday morning, it was gone. The only people that live here are you, me, and Grandma. You think Grandma stole it? And I was like, yeah, you probably were onto something, right? And I said, if you knew I stole it, why didn't you tell me to stop? He said, I asked you many times if you took it, and you said no. I said, but you knew I did. He said, Jason, stealing isn't wrong until it's wrong to you, and I'd rather you steal from me than our neighbors or your friends. And that's the guy I thought was out to get me, right? That's the guy I thought hated me. So I got in my car. I called John. He goes, how much do you have to pay back? I said, nothing. So I went back, and I ended up buying my grandpa cable TV till the day he died, right? And I remember he called me 2 weeks after he got cable TV, like a little kid. He's like, man, do you have cable TV? I said, Grandpa, everybody has cable TV. He said, do you have Pawn Stars? We talked about Pawn Stars, the History Channel. We talked about ESPN being on 24 hours. We talked about Newses being on 24 hours. We talked about all sorts of stuff, right, on about TV. And at the end of that conversation, he said to me, man, this is one of the coolest gifts anybody's ever got me. And I was making an amends, right? And when he passed, I was his favorite, right? And that's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? You guys taught me how to be part of. My grandma, on the other hand, she would pass. I don't know if anybody has anybody in here that loved him no matter what, or anybody that believed in him no matter what, that maybe didn't get to see you get sober, right? And that guilt and that shame that you carry down sometimes when you drive by something, you're reminded, you see something, it hurts. And I just didn't know how to do it. I sat with Howard P. a long time. I did a lot of work. I went to the graveside. I looked for dragonflies, butterflies, ants, potato bugs. And I tried anything, right? You told me to do it. I tried it. And I could get relief, but I couldn't kill that ache, right? And one day I'm flying home on a plane. I get a story from this guy, Jimmy Jack. And Jimmy Jack said, I'm the kind of guy that he could give me clear-cut directions, and I just look like I was in a haze. But if he told me a story, and I'd pay attention, and I could feel it, and he got me. And he told me this story about this little boy who was the firstborn in his family, and his sisters were born, and he got really jealous because his dad started paying attention to his sisters. So he went and asked his mom and dad if he could play football, and right away they signed him up, and right away he realized this is a big mistake, right? He's a trumpet player, not a football player. He don't like cold weather, and he don't like to be touched. But he kept playing because after every practice and every game, his dad would come find him and give him a hug and tell him he loved him and how proud he was of him. So the kid kept playing all the way to his senior year. And his senior year, 2 weeks before the big game, his team is going to the state championship. The coach calls him over at practice and says, son, I don't know how to tell you this, but your dad had a heart attack today, and he didn't make it. And the young man hit his knees and started crying. And he got up, and he asked the coach in front of all his friends, is it okay if I go home a little early today? Coach said, this is just a game. Go home and take care of your family. So the young man got up, and he didn't come back. The big game came, and he didn't show up till the third quarter of the game, and his team's losing by a lot. And he runs out. Everybody starts cheering. He runs up to the coach and asks if he could play, and the coach says, sure, we're losing anyway. And he goes in there, and the young man intercepts the ball and runs it back for a touchdown. And everybody starts clapping, and pretty soon he makes some tackles, and he ends up winning the game, the state championship for the team. The worst player in the history of the school just won the state championship, right? And they carry him off like a Rudy moment, and he's in the locker room that night, and the coach is walking out, and he sees him sitting there by himself, and he walks over to him. He says, man, take as long as you want. You know, just take as long as you want. And the young man says, thanks. And the coach says, hey, I need to ask you a question. He said, what happened out there tonight? He goes, you're not really the best athlete I've ever coached. That was a phenomenal game of football. The young man says, coach, I don't know if you know this or not, but every game that we played, every game that I sat on the bench and you didn't put me in or I lost the game for us, no matter what, my dad would come find me, and he'd give me a hug and tell me he loved me and how proud he was of me. And the coach said, man, you had a great dad. And he says, starts to walk away. The young man says, coach, I don't know if you know this or not, but my dad was blind. And tonight's the first night he ever really got to see me play. And just like that, I got relief. Because I know that every time I walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I say, my name's Jason Johnson, I'm an alcoholic. Or I walk into a meeting of alcoholics and I see somebody I haven't seen before. And I shake their hand and maybe get them a cup of coffee. My grandma gets to see that. You guys did that for me, right? I know that when I die and I go to that big meeting in the sky, that's the first place that I'm going to go because there's got to be a Bill, a Bob, and a Jesus. If there isn't, I'll let you guys know somehow, some way. It won't be a butterfly, but it'll be something, right? But I know who's going to be waiting to greet me out in the parking lot. It'll be my grandparents, right? And my grandpa, if you're not a half hour early, you're late, so I don't know how that works when you're dead. But he'll wave at me because he never thinks I know where I'm going. But here's the deal. For the first time in my life, I'm going to walk up to my grandpa, and because I've been hugging the men in Alcoholics Anonymous when it wasn't convenient or necessary, I'm going to be able to hug my grandpa for the first time and tell him I love him and thank him for giving me a safe place to live. My grandma, on the other hand, she's going to be dancing around, praising Jesus and thanking God and telling my grandpa, I told you so. And I know what she's going to do. She's going to hug me. She's going to tell me she loved me. And she's going to tell me she's proud of me. And for the first time in my life as an adult, I'm going to be able to look my grandma in the eyes and say, Grandma, it's the damnedest thing. These people in this program called Alcoholics Anonymous, they found a solution to their problem and they introduced it to me. But most importantly, Grandma, some of those folks showed me some grace. And in doing that, they introduced me to a guy inside of here that you only believed existed. I owe everything I have to Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything I want to be, everything I'm going to be. That might not be a big deal to you, but if you're a drunk who's powerless over alcohol, it's a big deal. I want to end with one story and I'm done. A few months ago, I had to go speak at the Indiana State Convention. And it's one of those conventions where it's five states come together and it's all their delegates and GSR. I mean, it's trust. I mean, it's like AA politics, right? I'm not that guy, right? So you might have found that in the story to believe I'm not that guy, right? And I get there and I'm looking at all this stuff and it's a whole weekend of it. And I told this guy I'm with, I said, man, you got the wrong speaker. I'll pay for my own way home, right? You guys need to find somebody that he can relate to. I'm not the guy. He's like, oh, God picks the people. I'm like, okay, but there's a banner that says a seat for everyone. I was like, that's going to bite him in the butt in about 24 hours, but let's do her, right? And so that weekend, what I did is I started participating. Man, I had a blast. I had a blast, right? I learned some stuff. I met some people, and I had a blast. And that night came for the banquet, and I gave my talk. And after the talk, they have these gratitude lines sometimes, and I don't know. I don't know why they call it a gratitude line, because 10% of the people don't like you, right? They're either 5% of them are only doing it because they just got done telling their sponsor, that's an hour of my life I'll never get back. And so they're like, oh, thank him for that, right? And the other five, you either swore, talked about drugs, or, yeah, they just don't like you. And so you know who they are. You can see them coming. And I'm standing at this line, and I'm greeting these people, and I look out, and I see this lady, and I tell them, okay, that? And I went, ooh, geez, because she had that look, right? So I'm shaking. I look again, and she's staring right at me, and I'm like, oh, that's it. That's the lady. She's going to tear into me, right? And she just looked pissed off, right? And so she should be here by now, right, to where I'm at. Because I know how this works, right? She should be here. And I look up, and she's not there. And I'm like, oh. I look back. She's at the end of the line looking at me. I'm like, oh, this is bad. You know, it sucks, right? I'm screwed. And sure enough, it gets down. It's just her and I, and we're just standing there. And she's looking at me, and I'm looking at her. I have my hands in my pockets. And she said, I'm a grandma. Can I give you a hug? I said, God, absolutely. You know what I mean? I'm good with that, right? And I hug her, and we start talking, and she says, you know, I have a granddaughter that's 24 years old, and she's out there running and gunning. And people are saying a lot of bad things about her and saying she's doing a lot of bad things with her body. But she's my granddaughter, and I love her. And I don't want to give up on her. And I said, we talked a little bit more. And she said, you know what's cool about this thing? She said, I'm not a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not a member of Al-Anon. I'm here because a friend of mine who comes to church every Sunday and prays for my granddaughter, her and her husband had tickets to this banquet for tonight. He got sick, and she called me to see if I wanted to come hear a story of hope. I want to thank you for giving me some hope. And I just stood there. I got those goosebumps, right? That feeling like, oh, man. And I said, thanks. And she started to walk away, and she turned around. She said, hey, you ever figure out why your grandma wrote all that stuff down in the books? I said, no. I asked my grandpa one time. He just laughed and said, he's sure glad she did. He turned the channel on the TV. But I said, I never really figured it out. She goes, I know. Why? I go, why is that? Because your grandma knew all the bad things that you were doing and people were saying about you. She knew that one day you would come back and make that right. Right? And I just started crying. I couldn't stop. Right? And she walked away and she looked right at me. She said, I'm proud of you. And she walked away. And I sat down in a chair and I started crying. I wasn't crying because I was sad. I was crying because the gratitude I have for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Right? And I'm standing there, and I look, and there's some feet standing there, and I look, and there's this big guy standing there. So I stand up, he's crying, he gives me a hug, and he goes, man, I heard everything she said. He goes, I felt that. I felt that. It gave me goosebumps. And I could hear Howard P. say, man, when you get goosebumps, that God tapping you on the shoulder saying you're welcome. Right? And I looked at him, I thought, my God, that's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope that everybody can come in here and feel something that moves them to an emotion. Maybe it's a laughter, maybe it's a cry, maybe it's just a good feeling, because that's the buzz, right? If you're new here and you're struggling, or if you're just struggling, having a bad time, and you're here today, thank you for not giving up on yourself. Thanks.